Hey everyone, this is John.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Super Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is the Super Nintendo edition of the Nintendo Show, where we talk about Super Nintendo games in semi-chronological order. We are up to September of 1993, so the games that we are going to talk about, plus one, all came out 21 years ago as of this month. Are the games on tap?
So they're all of drinking age.
They are all of drinking age, and the ones we have on tap are Zombies Ate My Neighbors, Mortal Kombat, and we're going to talk about F-Zero a little bit.
Okay, cool.
You know, it's a game that comes up fairly often. This game,
well,
and
I just
probably Final Fight, come
up
the most often.
I distinctly remember last time we talked about it, you and Wes went really hard after it, and I kind of want to give a better defense of it because I think this game is worthwhile.
We run a pretty good spectrum,
yeah.
The three of us, because you really like it. Wes really hates it. And there are things that I don't like about it, but I can see, I can understand that there are also things to appreciate about it. Wes hates it irrationally. He just, I don't think he's ever really played it. He just looks at it like, no, this is dumb. I hate it.
This is stupid. They didn't even show you the developer. They're afraid. They're ashamed.
Anyway. So, I guess maybe we'll just jump right in with Zombies Ate My Neighbors, which came out September 24th, 1993, developed by LucasArts, which actually surprised me, and also published by Konami. One of the interesting things about this game, and one of the interesting things about actually both games, both of the, new games we've never talked about before, one of the interesting things about them is they both were subject to censorship. Because of Nintendo's pretty strict violence guidelines for this particular generation. So in this one, the original design concept had red blood, some gore in it, because it's the zombie apocalypse. But
you'd think it would get a little messy.
Right, but Nintendo had changed the color to purple.
Yeah.
So I guess.
Oh, so like at the end when you die and it rolls
the game over
purple,
screen. Yeah.
That should be red.
Right.
To signify that you've just been violently killed.
Right. But instead it's purple to signify who knows what.
Yeah.
Something bad has happened. But well, let's start there. The game has a pretty cool visual style.
I only clocked basically half an hour playing it with you just now. But
actually, I think we got closer to an hour. I think time was passing.
We played through
by
about seven or eight stages.
Yeah.
I was having a lot of fun with it. I think it was a pretty cool game.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun. And I think that a lot of times, doing some of the research on this game before I took the plunge and bought it, it was classified as a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say that on the Super Nintendo, I immediately think Contra. And it's not,
it's like an isometric shooter, if that.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's not a whole lot of emphasis on a lot of the run and gun. You will do some running, that's for sure. And there is a, you know, that sort of gunning aspect to it as well.
Yeah.
But I'm not really sure on how to describe the primary gameplay aspect of it. You do shoot zombies and enemies.
Well, it seems more like it's item collecting and puzzle solving. It would be like if you were to play one of the dungeons in Link to the Past. It doesn't explicitly say, kill everything and you win. You don't have to do that.
Right.
It's really more or less just collecting the items you need, navigating through obstacles, mazes, puzzles, things like that.
And most of those items that you need are keys to unlock doors. Because you're basically searching for your, like, 10 people, 10 non-zombie people who are occupying a particular stage in some way.
Who also can themselves be killed by the same things that are attacking you.
Right, and I've never encountered, like, I don't know exactly how many you need before it is, sorry, game over. Maybe you can progress from stage to stage only rescuing one of 10, but once you've rescued all of the survivors, you know, your exit doors literally appear from thin air, and then you're able to move on. Or, you know, you can stick around in the levels.
And not necessarily immediately. I mean, there was one where they gave you the exit door, and then I was floundering, surrounded by bad guys.
So that was a weird situation, because I think that maybe the particular like corridor we were in, like the dead end hallway.
They might have been able to spawn it because it was kind of tight, and they were dispersed such that they might not want to spawn them on top of the bad guys.
Or maybe the game was just making fun of us. That's also a possibility.
This is LucasArts.
So, to me, I think the highlight of the game is actually moving around through levels because there's some pretty cool, not super varied, but with good enough variety level design. Because, you know, you're in like a lot of suburb areas. There's a part where you're in a shopping mall and then inexplicably in a pyramid at one point in a castle.
Yeah.
So they do a pretty good job of...
Most suburbs have a pyramid.
is that true?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, let's just go with that. So they do a pretty good job of having those different types of environments, but basically it is a facelift, a visual makeover of the same sort of concept. You're in a sort of maze. Sometimes the corridors are tighter than others, but you're in a limited area, and you're trying to navigate your way in that area to access points where a survivor might be hiding.
Mm-hmm. And they also, you pointed it out, they do a really good job of preventing you from recircling through the same maps by closing off corridors once you've done what you can do in that area.
Yeah,
so
they
you
do
don't
that
end up trying to go all the way back to the very beginning to figure something out. You know, it's like, you're not going to waste your time running around looking for the one last thing. They are going to sort of funnel you in the direction that they want you to go.
And they do that in the pyramid. One area where I think they kind of lose track of that sort of guidance that they give you in other stages is like the hedge mage stage.
Mm-hmm.
The hedge maze stage, not the hedge mage.
Hedge mage. It's a wizard. Practices the occult.
That actually does sound like a viable enemy in this game.
Yes.
The hedge mage. But in that particular stage, the hedge maze, there is guys with chainsaws, and a lot of times the only way to get access to other areas in that maze is to have them chop through it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can sometimes be hard to avoid. They're not killable, which I guess works in the game's favor because you need them to progress to different areas in that stage.
Mm-hmm.
But they also are just as fast as you. So it's very hard to run from them and in order to compensate.
We played together, so we could kind of cover each other as
yeah.
When you played solo, do you have that problem where you basically just got them on your back
and
you
pretty much
have to run around until
you have to run around and hope they forget about you, or they give you those clown decoys, which they go after with pretty good success. Those are pretty good at being decoys.
Well, there's a lot of, it looks like, at least from what we saw, there's a lot of hidden alleyways and passages if you're just looking for them, but they're not explicit. Like, it, you know, when we were in the pyramid level, there's these big piles of sand, and they just look like big piles of sand, but you can pass through them. Like, you can walk into them. And we didn't realize that, or at least I didn't realize that,
no,
at the very end of the stage.
Right.
When it would have been so useful to have that early on.
But. Right. And there's advantages to poking into things. There's no action button. It's just pretty much if you want to interact with something, bump into it. Mm-hmm. And there are things like trash cans that sometimes have hidden keys or hidden ammunition, which is really valuable, as we came to find.
Yeah. Well, and there's different weapons, too. And, like, the different weapons actually kind of seem to correspond appropriately to the things that you're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for example, they've got the poisonous plant things, and what do they give you? They give you a weed whacker.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're going to use that on that route as opposed to the chainsaw, which actually, I mean, you could use on a chainsaw if you wanted.
Yeah, and the weapons that they give you, there's a bit of ammo management. Mm-hmm. So if you could use that weed whacker just against normal zombies that are running around if you wanted to, but it'd be better if you saved that for a particular point in the game.
Something specifically geared to be taken down by it.
Right. So they scatter mushrooms on the ground, and if you walk in them, you take damage. Mm. And the counter to that is you just using the weed whacker and walking along the ground with it, you know, just mowing down mushrooms in front of you. So we mentioned the chainsaw dudes. The mummies are another really tough character to defeat. I think they take 5 shots from your normal gun, and that's, you know, where co-op comes in most handy, like you mentioned before, so you can cover each other. One of the things that we both observed when we were playing the game is sometimes the hitbox isn't always as accurate or maybe as wide as you would hope for this kind of game where you're picking up a lot of items.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, it doesn't seem like It seems like you can clip on walls pretty easily.
Yeah.
Accidentally get stuck when in things where you feel as though you are safe to pass through them.
Yeah, and it's something that in this sort of isometric game, you know, maybe the Super Nintendo isn't quite powerful enough to...
Yeah, this game might be reaching a little bit beyond the boundaries of what a Super Nintendo should be doing.
Yeah, because, you know, it of course can't render polygons, so you're just working with these sprites, and they're trying to do an isometric view, so but you can't really have sprites walking behind each other. They do a little bit with trees. There are some trees that you can kind of walk behind, but they're not entirely successful with all of the walls that they put in there.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that I guess is a sort of a detriment to the game is that not only the hitbox, but sometimes just moving throughout the level feels a little bit loose. Sometimes it's hard to line up some really accurate shots. And with weapons that do a lot of damage, like your bazooka or with bombs, it's a little bit difficult to place them exactly where you want them.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't a whole lot of boss fights. I think in the eight levels that we played through, out of I don't know how many, we encountered one real boss, and that was the giant baby.
Yeah.
And which was a really annoying boss because of that, but we're also running out of ammo.
A bit jarring, too. Why are we fighting a large baby?
Right, exactly. It's a zombie apocalypse, and of course you're going to... Kill the giant baby.
And when we say giant, we're not talking like an 8-foot-tall baby. We're talking like an 80-foot-tall baby. This thing is huge.
And its primary attacks was it would just kind of run around and bump into you.
Mm-hmm.
And it would also have a bottle that it would squirt milk at you.
Yeah.
Like a baby.
And it was also, they didn't like, there's no like obvious thing to bring down the baby. And it ended up just being one of the special power-up items, right?
It instantly
used it and it died.
Exactly
700 points.
I think...
That's great.
I think that one of those secondary items that we used, it was also that plus damage that we had already done to it. I think it was just taking a lot of damage. Because I hit it with a few bazooka shots, and, you know, flashes yellow when it takes damage. But, you know, speaking of secondary items, we mentioned all the different, like, types of guns. We've mentioned bombs, bazookas, the weed whacker.
There's no radial bomb, of course.
No, unfortunately. But as for secondary items, there's things like your health items, or there's a potion that turns you into this big purple monster who can smash through hedges.
That is actually very useful. That was so useful when we were trying to get through that.
Right.
Because it got a little grindy at the end. We're like, what the hell are we doing here?
Exactly. So, it got a little bit tough at certain points to figure out where we'd been. But then there's also things that you can use for offense. Like, I think that secondary item we used was like a treasure chest icon, and it just, you know, You opened it up and just started wrecking people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we killed the giant baby. And then the only other secondary item that comes to mind is keys. And keys are just things that you pick up. And a lot of doors are locked. And some of them are...
Shoes? What do the shoes do? Do they just give you a permanent... Like, when you have them equipped, you're running faster? Or is there a button you're supposed to hold? I didn't really experiment around
with that. No, the shoes, you use them. It's a one-time use. And it increases your movement speed for a set amount of time.
Okay.
So it's not permanent, unfortunately. And, you know, most of the buttons, I mean, you have, like, your shoot button, like your attack button.
Well, it's two toggles, and then two uses. You have your weapon that you can toggle through, and then your actual attack with that weapon, and then you have your items, which you toggle, and your items, which you use.
Yeah, and I don't know, what do you think of that? I kind of thought that maybe it would be cool if they remapped that to, like, the shoulder buttons to scroll through.
That would make a little more sense.
Because at times, you know, when you're in a high panic situation, when you're being chased by five mummies, you're not always thinking, okay, I need to run, and this button toggles, and this button I need to turn and shoot. Like, it can be a little bit confusing.
I found myself doing that, where I thought I would be attacking, and I was just ended up cycling through the weapons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the shoulder buttons are much better suited to scroll through stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird about the game is, on your startup screen, you have start game, and you have a menu to input a password to continue a save point.
No options.
There's no options.
No mono or stereo.
No mono stereo. No difficulty setting. No option to increase your amount of lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, hey, get in there and start rescuing neighbors. And God, the password system. We've talked about this before on this particular show. Why not just make it so you can save?
Yeah,
it saves your high scores.
Yeah,
you can
saves the high scores and saves item your inventory, right? Because I assume if you're just plugging in those codes, they're just going to start you with default gear.
I think so. I hope so, because the code we have no ammo.
Yeah.
So
well, it's four letters too. I mean, how many?
Yeah,
how could they possibly have that enough?
Like, right. It's It's clearly not that complicated. Like, there's not too many lines of code that they have to retrieve, so why not just have a save point? Sometimes I think that maybe batteries for these particular cartridges were maybe a little bit expensive, so it was a cost-saving measure to not have actual saves. But, I don't know, it just doesn't feel very next-gen when you're inputting passwords. God, there are NES games where you can save. There are plenty of NES games where you actually like had a save feature, and you know, we're 3 years into the life cycle of the Super Nintendo and we're still not able to save in every game.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, yeah, I actually was enjoying this game quite a bit. It's
I had a really good time playing it when I did. The only thing I can worry about is what's the replay value of it? I mean, we got 7 stages deep. I don't know, unless there's like 50 stages, like unless there's so many stages that it's just like you can barely beat the game unless you clock hours. Like, once you kind of know where everything is, once you've figured out the general layout of the maps, which after a few times through, I would imagine you get a pretty good feel for it.
And it's true, it doesn't have the same replay value of, say, Contra 3, but which is another game where you can kind of memorize, but it like the action is so fast paced that it's going to be slightly different every time you play it. But yeah, I would be...
Well, I also don't worry about, like, oh no, 3 zombies spawned in this room this time, where it's like, you know, one of us dies in Contra, and then it is like, how do we respond to this? How do we regroup and get the right items and move forward? It's like, oh, you pretty much have the gear you need or you don't.
Yeah. So, in Zombies Ate My Neighbors, I would be surprised and probably maybe a little bit disappointed if the number of levels were in excess of 30. Because I think at that point the premise probably start wearing a little bit thin. I don't know. I kind of was getting the feeling that we were making some pretty good progress and maybe we're getting to a...
They were ramping up the difficulty.
Yeah.
And we were also having a little bit of... our resource management was not that great. We probably could have...
Well, I didn't expect...
Done a better job of that.
I didn't expect there to be such a scarcity of ammo as we're getting further into levels here. Like, at the first couple levels, like, yeah, here's just some guns lying around.
250 nail gun bolts. Who cares?
And then
I observe, oh, you don't even have to shoot them individually. You can just hold down the button and they just spit them out. It's like, great. Here's a really brilliant thing I just figured out.
So, yeah, but the game, it's got a lot of charm to it. There's it's probably the most silly and whimsical zombie apocalypse game I've played.
That's true. Yeah, the game had plenty of character. It was a lot of fun. And, I mean, it's has a lot of detailed stuff on the screen at all times that are just interesting to look at. There's a lot of eye candy in it for most of the designs being relatively simple.
Yeah, it's not a bland level layout like, say, Shadowrun, which I'm going to take every opportunity to bash in every podcast.
The game was kind of atrocious.
So this one, it's a little bit pricey. It's like $30 for a used cartridge on Amazon.
Yeah.
Which, you know...
It's in the Wii Store?
Yes, it is on the Wii U Virtual Console for $8. But then you're also getting into... Like, I think this game is best suited for co-op play. Like, single player worked just fine, but it was more fun to move through the levels using co-op.
By the way, they're not split screens. You share the screen.
Right.
So you control hard if you want and just not let people progress.
It's true. And something that this game also reminded me of was a Genesis game called Toe Jam and Earl. Do you ever play that one?
Sounds familiar. I don't know if I played it or can't remember playing it.
It was a similar level setup where it was isometric. You're moving through a level. You are searching for your objective. Once you find that objective, your exit will appear, and then you just move on to the next section. In this particular game, in Toe Jam and Earl, you're searching for your spaceship pieces. Your aliens who crash landed on a planet. You find your spaceship pieces, puts back together. You move on. And the view is very similar. It's got that top-down kind of isometric, but Toe Jam and Earl goes to a split screen. And through the rose-colored glasses of my 11-year-old self, it ran perfectly.
Yeah.
There were never any issues with Toe Jam and Earl running in split screen. However, if I were to play it again, I don't know if I'd see any of the issues that would come from rendering like an entire like map so that two people could move wherever they want in it.
The seams might show a little bit.
Yeah. So, and you know, that was also a weird game because not every level had a spaceship piece. I think there were like 18 spaceship pieces, so there are certain levels like, all right, you're here, go find your exit and move on. But there are a lot of like secondary items, as long as we're taking this weird Toe Jam mineral on the Sega Genesis tangent.
What is that, by the way? What is a Sega Genesis?
It's something we
don't know what that is.
And, well, we all know what happened to Sega in the hardware race, so it's okay to talk about them. It's the other competition we don't talk about.
It's the Betamax.
Yeah. So, Toe Jam
mineral. It's the RC Cola.
I just want to go into a restaurant. That's what I'm going to order from now. Because I've already made the hard stance where if I order a Coke and they say, is Pepsi okay? No. Yeah. You better bring me a Dr. Pepper then. Because I'm not drinking Pepsi. I'm not going to do it. I'm nearly 30 years old. I'm not making that compromise anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, RC Cola, I think, is what I'll move on to next. So, in Toe Jam mineral, I think the primary hook of the gameplay is that there are a ton of different items that you can pick up. It's like in Zombies Ate My Neighbors, there are shoes that you can get that last a limited amount of time that make you run faster. But you can also like pick up, and all the items last a limited amount of time. But like there's tomatoes and you throw them at your enemies. There's wings that you use.
Well, pretty generous with the health items. I mean, we were like 4 stages in and I didn't even realize the red box meant health. And it's a full heal. Like, so yes. If you have that 1 hit point left, you're back to full.
Sure. They're not super generous with lives. I think, you know, in levels 1 through 8, with all the points that we were racking up, I got 1 extra life.
That's true.
Throughout the entire game. But, yeah, we racked up a good amount of health items, but it's not like in every level where we're like, oh, there's a healing item and there's a healing item. It's not like they were scattered all over the place either. So,
yeah,
you know, they put the passwords in there so that you can continue the progress. The save point would have been better, though. Mm-hmm. But I don't even remember why we got on the Toe Jam mineral tangent.
I don't know. You just had it in you. You were like, okay, yeah, I'm talking about this. Oh, no. We were talking about having to share the screen.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
The ability to prevent someone from progressing on their own accord.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that this game might have benefited from some split screen if that were technically possible. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It works just fine the way it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we move on to Mortal Kombat?
Yeah.
If we must. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a whole lot of notes about Mortal Kombat.
I don't think much are needed. And I actually, in my youth, I played a lot of this game, but I would also go back and tell myself that I should have just stopped playing that and started playing a little more Street Fighter.
Yeah, and we're going to make a lot of comparisons to Street Fighter.
By the way, we are reviewing, basically, Mortal Kombat, not its other sequels, which do actually add a lot more content to it and a lot more playable characters.
But yeah, this original Mortal Kombat port of the arcade version is a very bare-bones fighting game. Let's just start out with saying Mortal Kombat came out September 13th, 1993, developed and published by Midway, according to the internet, but Acclaim, according to the credits in the game. Midway and Acclaim may be the same company. They might have changed their name, but I don't know. I lost track of a lot of those early 90s developers as they've changed names and changed parent companies and folded and gone away forever.
Well, when you first started it up, I was like, oh, it's an Acclaim game, right? And you're like, oh, it's Midway. And then the flash came up.
There's Acclaim. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, at least that's what I remember it loading up as. But, I mean, like you said, it could just be a merger or something like that. They could... be essentially the same studio down the line.
And if I cared enough, I'd probably look it up. Probably really easy to find.
Yeah, who gives a shit?
But so...
I mean, who really wants to take responsibility for this one?
So the original... It's funny that you mentioned that, because it, as I was doing some research that, you know, may be faulty, I found that this was a game that was given to the developer. I forget the specific branch of Midway / Acclaim that developed it. There was actually credit for it at the beginning of the cartridge. There was a flash screen for the actual name of the development studio. They were tasked with making a fighting game, and they basically said, you got a year to do it. And they're making, and they originally made it for the arcade. And a lot of the assumptions is it was something to go against Street Fighter II. They probably achieved some pretty good success in popularity, but in terms of something in enduring,
yeah, and there, well, it is still a long running. If you like look at the Evo tournaments, the big 2D fighting tournaments, it's now Injustice, and Injustice is essentially a, through very many changes of skins and things like that, you're still basically looking at the core gameplay of a Mortal Kombat game.
So the original arcade version was ported to the Super Nintendo, censored, just like Zombies Ate My Neighbors. They took out the blood. Any blood that would be in, or remains in, Mortal Kombat has been changed to a green goo. So, and actually, we might as well start with the visual style of this as well, since that kind of relates to replacing the blood with goo. This game looks absolutely hideous. This is an atrocious looking game.
It is so dated because also at the time, like, they do, it's sort of like a rotoscoping thing where they're using real people. And they're using like the actual, like the sprites themselves aren't hand animated. They're actually just pictures of people. Doing fighting stances and doing kicks and things like that. So then it actually probably did look a little more.
It probably looked, well, I can remember this game looking amazing. It has not aged well.
No, it's aged terribly as a result of that. And it's, that all of the characters feel very limited and robotic in their gameplay. The core move sets are identical. You know, everybody, if you hold back and low kick, you're going to do a sweep. You hold back and up kick, you're going to do a roundhouse. The punches are all the same. They all have an uppercut. There's just there's no character to any of the way that these people play. Like, usually you have eight different options total? Seven.
You got seven playable characters, and they're all exactly the same.
The only thing that really matters is the moves, their special moves they have. So if there's one that you think has better moves, that's probably who everyone should play every time.
And I feel like they also maybe, like, move at slightly different speeds. There doesn't seem to be a huge discernible difference, though. Like, maybe one character is slightly slower than the other. But, I'm just going to go back to the visual style for a quick second here. They went for, like, that photorealistic look, and what they ended up with, in retrospect, is these really pixelated-looking JPEGs. Like, congratulations, you have this really terrible-looking person, especially
which
when,
we say now, knowing, like, where, like, and now there's a love of pixel art. Now it's almost like there's this nostalgia that people, like, yearn for when they look at these old games that, you know, some of these other fighters, and by the way, it's not just Street Fighter. It doesn't have to be, like, a Mortal Kombat for Street Fighter. There's other fighters out there that just still hold up so much better and look so much better by comparison.
But Street Fighter is definitely the one that first comes to mind because they're contemporaries of each other. They were games that, they were in direct competition. Like, it was Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat were the arcade machines next to each other, and it was the
Later on, Killer Instinct got a box.
But see, it's an interesting comparison to make, as long as we're going down this road, because Street Fighter went for the more pixel art style. Very well animated art style, was definitely not going for photorealism. Put a lot of resources into creating a depth of combat, which is why it's still very much a playable game, whereas 15 minutes with Mortal Kombat, like, all right, I know exactly what this is, let's move on. Because there's nothing really to discover, whereas in Street Fighter II, there's more to uncover and more to figure out as you play the game more and more. It's also an interesting kind of early look at Western versus Japanese developed games, because you have something like Street Fighter, which they just go for that kind of cartoony visual, the animated visual style, and a lot of depth to the gameplay. And Mortal Kombat, they're looking for the most technologically advanced looking thing. They're looking for the hyper violence. Mm-hmm. And that's really the appeal of the game, is those fatalities, the things that you do when all gameplay has ended.
Yeah, it really is. For this to be their marquee thing that happens, it's really awful. I mean, it doesn't elevate the gameplay at all, the fact that you do this. And really, it's a taunt. All you're doing is you're just taunting your opponent.
Yep.
And if you're playing in an arcade or something, your opponent's probably already walked away. They're not going to sit around. Well, I mean, maybe if they have some kind of bloodlust, they'll...
If they got another quarter sitting on the cabinet.
Maybe if I was 13 years old, I'd be like, oh, look at how violent this is. I don't care about that anymore.
And that was the thing.
There's violence in games already that I'm just more interested in cerebral combat than I am in watching someone like get decapitated.
Right, you actually want to engage in playing the game rather than... Because the most engaging thing about Mortal Kombat was sitting around the lunch table in the cafeteria and like, oh, and you know, if you play as this guy, his fatalities, he rips out the guy's heart and holds it up and it's still being like, yeah, fantastic. Yeah,
that's great. And also the fact that they are really convoluted combos you have to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no real point to doing it other than the desire to see the violent thing.
Right. Like, hey, guess what? I can do this. Congratulations. Well done.
You remember this bizarre esoteric move that you have to pull off that certain distance from the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And, you know, to me, it's a little bit sad that, well, first of all, I'll be fair to Western games. They have evolved past just that sort of bloodlust and shallow gameplay. But I think that the appeal of that sort of photorealistic visual style and the appeal of hyperviolence hasn't really gone away. It's just woven better into actual gameplay than it had been in the past. And the thing that makes me sad about it is that now it seems to come at the expense of a lot of the more Japanese-centric game development styles that, you know, were really at odds with Western styles back then. But companies like Capcom and Konami have moved a lot heavier into developing Western-style games.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, that, because I get it, that's where the money is, but that's not the kind of game I want to play.
Yeah.
I'd rather play Mega Man than, you know, another Resident Evil 6.
Yeah. By the way, I'm certainly not going to put my neck out for the Mortal Kombat series, but this is just a really, really bad first entry.
Yeah.
Mortal Kombat 2 is a marked improvement. I'm not going to say it's great or anything, but it's better. And then they released Ultimate Mortal Kombat 2, which contributed a little more, I think, made the characters a little bit more dynamic.
And, you know...
We'll talk about that down the road. I mean, there's going to be time to talk about this, but...
Good for them for actually taking something where they had achieved some success by having, like, those really lowest common denominator.
It's crass, appealing things. It's the crass base material that is what has made this such a popular, long-standing series.
But good for them for taking that and evolving it and trying to turn it into something that actually has compelling gameplay. God, I hate myself for even saying that phrase. I sound like such a fucking game journalist. Compelling gameplay. Fuck. All right, should we move on from Mortal Kombat, talk about F-Zero?
Sure, yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay, so this is just something that has I've been stewing over, because last time we talked about this, you guys went really hard after it. Well, you like you said, you were kind of in the middle, Wes really does not like F-Zero.
I like to let him off the reins sometimes, though. I like to let him rant about how much he hates stuff.
I don't even remember what his beef was with this game, but I think this is a fantastic racer. And I kind of want to give a little more in-depth and talk about it. We played a little bit, so yeah. you can talk about your impressions of it as well. But I think that this is an interesting counterpoint to playing something like a Mario Kart. Because Mario Kart is not really a racer to me. It is just a... I mean, I don't know how you would describe it. I mean, you technically are racing in cars, but there's so much more to it. There's so much more about the people you're playing with, the items you collect. I think this is a... When you play F-Zero, you're playing what is designed to be a tight racer.
Yeah.
Like a really strong mechanics, really stable, very accurate with the touch and control, both on the handling and on the gas and brake. The maps are just dizzyingly complex. Far more complex than what you would get in any Mario Kart game. And you're expected to be able to navigate through these with not only opponents, but traffic. Who, by the way, are not given the same weights that you are. They're not given the same handicap that you're given. This is just a fun, fun game.
And the way I kind of distinguish F-Zero from Mario Kart is, in a game like Mario Kart, which has evolved quite a bit since its inception, is that Mario Kart is a game that you don't necessarily have to be able to race well in order to do well. They have those things like items that will kind of help you along and keep you at least engaged in the gameplay, even if you're not winning. In Mario Kart, you can race extremely well. You can master courses and shortcuts and when to use certain items to gain a competitive advantage. You can do that all extremely well and still not win. You can play a race perfectly, but then you always still have those wild cards. Oh, the red shells or blue shells or someone who uses a star at the exact right time. And even though you've done everything else 100% perfectly, you don't get that payoff of winning. And I was talking about it earlier, but when you're in Mario Kart, especially in Mario Kart 8, which is, of course, the most recent one that I've been extremely frustrated with at times, you can, on the hardest difficulty levels, just racing against computers, just in the regular Grand Prix, you can race everything perfectly. But if you get hit at with a shell at the right moment, you drop down from first down to sixth. And because because you're in the middle of the pack and everyone's getting items and tossing them around, you just get bombarded. So you go from...
Whenever I play a Mario Kart game, I mostly play to troll for that reason. I mean, I will play. I don't care. It's not about winning. It's as much as it is about... seeing someone that's already been kicked in the dirt and then just popping them off the shell. You know? It's a game that creates spite and hate.
Yeah.
Not to say it's not fun, and not to say that you can't get a little bit of a kick out of that, but I think that it's, if you're going into like a Mario Kart race with the idea that I'm going to get first place, you're going in with bad intentions.
And see, that's the thing is, they reward you for, like, especially like in the single player Grand Prix, they reward you for getting, hey, you got first place, here's the highest accolades you can get, and by the way, you now have unlocked this stuff. And if you want to get everything that you can unlock, you have to go for those. And there are times where, you know, I'm playing the hardest difficulty levels in Mario Kart, and I'm saying, you know, I wish just for like this highest difficulty race, I could just turn off items, because the computers are good enough at the races to where it's competitive, even if they're not using items. I wish I could just turn items off, just do pure racing to where, you know, where you have to navigate the turns and like draft up behind other racers in order to gain some speed, just so that I can get through them without having to worry about, okay, now I'm in first, how far back is the next person behind me? Am I going to get popped with a blue shell at any point here? It just becomes about playing the track. And that's what F-Zero does really well, is that, you know, you do have obstacles.
You have one item. F-Zero gives you one item, and you're given one every lap, and it's your boost. And it's not something that's to anyone's detriment. It's just to your benefit if you use it right.
Right. And well, it could also be to your detriment as well.
That's true, yeah. If you use it at the wrong time, or if you use it in traffic, you can just create a world of hurt for yourself. Also, the health mechanic.
Yeah.
Much like, if I'm not mistaken, in Mario Kart, if you go off the stage, the little guy will come pick you up and put you back on the track, and you're going to lose a lot of momentum. Other people are going to pass you.
Yeah.
But you're still in the race. F-Zero, you go off the track, you take a ramp, and you go off the track, you're dead. Start the race over.
Yeah.
From the very beginning.
And I don't know if that has carried over. I haven't played F-Zero X or GX in a long, long time. I can't remember if that's carried over exactly in that same way. But yeah, it's one of those things where...
It's a bit brutal.
It again, encourages you to learn the tracks and pick your spots. Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, also, if you... It gives you the idea that you can use the S anywhere on the track you want. But in most tracks, you find that there's like a very specific sweet spot where you're going to maximize the use of it and like get through this maybe difficult part, or maybe they just give you this really wide open space, and it's the best way to just get through it. Also, the time trial element is really, really cool. I don't know if Mario Kart did this as well, but they measure it to hundredths of a second.
I don't know if that got that specific.
The times that you pull on the track. So there is this desire, this really strong desire to get the best possible time, even if you are in first place on every single lap. You'd kind of like to know how you maximized it best.
Yeah, and it's... Oh, shoot, I just lost my train of thought. Hang on.
Yeah.
I'm going to edit this later.
No.
No, of course not.
Oh, no.
it does a good job of establishing a sense of speed. Because it calculates those hundredths of a second, which probably contributes to that. But
you're moving at kilometers per.
Yeah, like 400 kilometers per hour is like the speedometer they give you, which, it's using like, tricks. Like, and it uses like the FX chip inside the cartridge. You can actually feel the weight of the cartridges. It's a little bit heavier than other cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that's the extra FX chip inside of it. But it uses. Those sort of plane perspectives to create this illusion that you're playing a 3D game, and it also helps create that sense of speed because the plane is moving around your car and they're like throwing so many colors moving past you so well that it feels
beautifully
like you're pretty
detailed
fast.
Too for as much open space as you cover in the game, for as wide open and vast and as fast as you move, and it's just how much turf there is. You get a lot of detail out of it, and the backgrounds are consistently gorgeous. And they kind of, you move in this, I mean, it's just basically like you're in a big bubble with a nice background of a wall.
Yeah.
But it's so detailed and really well articulated. This, like, when you're in Mute City, you actually feel like you're racing on top of this city, where if you just sit there and pause and aren't moving, you can look and see all of how much detail is in all of these little individual buildings. You know, it's just, it looks great. The color palette is awesome, by the way, too. Each of the colors have their own each of the maps have their own coordinating colors, so you kind of get a sense for what they are.
Yeah. One thing that I thought they probably could have done better, and this is probably a limitation of technology, is sometimes you get onto a track and it just kind of looks like, and instead of racing above something, it just kind of looks like you're racing on a completely flat surface. And
yeah, there is no elevation in the... Well, I mean, was there any elevation in like the Mario Kart games either? I mean, I feel like do they have like hills and valleys and ramps? Or
not
like...
not in a Super Mario Kart, that's for sure. But once you get to Mario Kart 64, which F-Zero also evolved past just the flat surfaces as well.
That's actually, it's bizarre for as big as a homer as I am for F-Zero. At the same time, I never really played any of the newer versions of the game. Like, pretty much just stuck to F-Zero. I've dabbled a little bit with the others, but this one is just near and dear to my heart.
Well, in a few years, we'll get to the Nintendo 64. We'll be able to dabble in F-Zero X.
I'm going to be such a rookie when it comes to that. I played very little 64.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's not quite the same breadth of different types of games. But, we'll actually get into more.
I mean, some people say that one of the best Zelda games can be found in the 64.
So. Yeah, it's true. Also, a lot of real high-quality games. You get Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, and you also get into more first-person shooters, which is what get Wes real excited.
Yeah.
Me, not so much.
I had two things I want to talk about still.
Yeah, sure. Go.
One is how, when you're playing a Mario Kart, there's different items that you can get. There's different shells and there's different things, with banana peels and all that. F-Zero doesn't provide them to you as power-ups and pickups, but they provide them to you in the stage design. The rails themselves are going to hurt you, and you actually have a health bar, which is cool. You have a health bar, rather than just, falling off the stage, getting back on, and you can run into walls over and over again in some other games and you're fine. But in this one, you actually have to be very conservative and do clean laps, as clean laps as you can. But you can kind of scrape the walls and you're okay. You hit them with enough force, they're going to bounce you back and do a lot of damage. But then there's also the rails that can line them that will suck you in and then chip you away with damage. So you have to kind of be prepared to grind off against them. There's landmines there. There's ramps that you can hit. And if you're not careful with the ramps, you could easily just fly off the track altogether. The little bombs they have on the stages. There's just so much. You have, of course, the tar pits, like the tar turf that slows you down dramatically. There's ice, which, even though I think your cars are supposed to be hovering, the ice still makes you slide. And then there's ice tar, which has a totally different thing where it slows you down, but then even gives you less traction, so you're liable to just slide into more walls.
That's mean.
And the stages, too. You start with like the three different stages of the levels. You go through just all of the core. I think there's, six or seven different stages. And then you go from, knight to queen to king. And every time you make that step, they change the map around a little bit. And you can actually see where the paths are going to be when you make the upgrade to the next hardest level. And by the time you're at the king mode, it just gets absurdly difficult. It's just so complex, and you really have to be on your game. You really have to just be so sharp with the controls when you play. And as frustrating as it is, it's also incredibly rewarding when you are able to get these laps down.
And I think that was my biggest complaint about the game, is that it can be really frustrating at times. As much of a precision racer as it is, and it's much more of a precision racer than Mario Kart, it does feel like at times there's that element of randomness to where you can be doing something really well. Someone will come up behind you and just smash you into a wall.
Yeah.
And then you go totally off the rails. You miss the ramp that you're supposed to hit, and then you're exploding.
You're four spots back, yep. And then you're stuck in traffic while trying to navigate. And that's the other thing. You have actual traffic on the road you have to get around, which is just such a pain.
Yeah.
And they're not subject to the NPC characters are not subject to the same issues you have to deal with.
And there's some pretty heavy rubber banding as well.
Yeah.
Where you're never just going to, even on the easiest difficulty settings, you're never just going to be able to blow anyone away with speed.
Yeah.
You're always going to be able to keep up with you.
Well, I mean, as long as you're basically doing, approximately as well as you can on the track. I'm not saying you have to be 100% perfect every time. But as long as you seem to be traveling as best you can without making any real major mistakes, you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But the second you start scraping walls, bumping into traffic, they'll be nipping at your heels.
Yeah.
Ready to get in front of you. So, and then, if you had five perfect laps, you should be seconds ahead of your opponents. And then you make that one mistake and then they beat you. Like, those happen. And it's kind of regrettable. That is one thing that I think the game does poorly. That is one element of the game. Two things that should be changed about it. One, probably that. Maybe give you little dots so you kind of know where your opponents are on the map. And then two, co-op. There really is, or not co-op, but having a chance to race someone else. You can do time trials. So you can do time trials with someone else and go for the best time. But it's not necessarily the same. And you don't get a ghost. You don't get to have the ghost of their car you're racing against. So,
yeah. All right. Anything else you want to throw out there about
F-Zero? I did have 2 points.
Yeah,
the other point was the cars themselves. There's 4 different cars you can choose from, and it's kind of nice. There is enough to justify having 4 different cars. And they all specialize in different things. One has really great acceleration but low top speed. One has really high top speed but low acceleration. Some handle better than others. And depending upon the course that you're on, it's going to be a huge advantage to be one over the other. I just want to say it's a simple but refined racer. I think I forget that word. You use precision. This is definitely a precision racer, and it looks good and it plays great.
Yep, and it's a real cheap cartridge. It's definitely something worth trying out if you're into racers or just difficult games.
Mm-hmm.
If you're feeling a little sadistic.
Yeah.
I think it's also on the Wii Virtual Console. I don't know if I'd go as far just to say, hey, you need to pay $8 for this thing. If you got a functional Super Nintendo, a couple bucks for a cartridge is definitely the way to go.
Yep.
So that's going to bring this show to a close. And actually, just a couple days, me and Norris are going to be recording the official show. I think we're going to be recording on Monday. So it was a tough day for you.
Yeah, it is. I got my movie night.
Yep. But me and Wes are going to be spending quite a bit of time with a new game, Hyrule Warriors, which we're both excited about.
Okay.
Got a co-op going. And then after that, we're going to start up the cycle again with the Pokemon show, which I'm excited about. Yes. You're going to rank the dragons.
Oh, okay, great. Oh, yeah. Well, that'll be interesting to do.
Yeah, it'll be quick, too, so...
There's not that many.
Yeah, I think we're both interested in starting up a Gen 4 Nuzlocke. So, you know, if you're able to get all your guys transferred over...
Yeah.
Off your Gen 4 cartridge. And
well, as you saw, like, because I got a second-hand cartridge for Platinum, and it's got the old save state. And the guy that had it before was... well, for starters, he broke the game. Like, he was making dupes. In some way, he was hacking it. And on top of that, he left me with some great stuff, but he took all of his really, really top-shelf things that would be the rarest and most valuable, so...
Yeah.
Troy, thank you, but fuck you.
It'd be, if you're able to, we'll get to the Gen 4 Nuzlocke discussion.
This would be fun. That's why I got it. Like, I'm really amped up to do it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
But yeah,
going with Pillip.
Oh, good. I started off with Chimchar. I've actually started mine already.
You said one of only two fires, I guess.
There's him and Ponyta. Those are the two fires in the game.
Man, that's rough on the fire types.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the level or the world design, and we'll get into more detail in the actual show.
How many Starlies you got?
Actually, zero.
For real?
Yeah.
Nice.
Two Shinxes, though.
Lucky bastard.
So if you get a Starly, I will trade you for a Shinx if you don't have one.
Yeah, you'll need a flyer. Chimchar can't fly.
No, but I also do. There's things about the game that you can. In a Nuzlocke, kind of manipulate what Pokemon... Like, there's ways to guarantee, like, I'm going to get this Pokemon in this particular area.
Yes.
Specifically, in Valley Windworks on Fridays, Drifblim will appear just on the screen. It's really easy just to use a Repel.
Oh, nice.
Make sure everyone else is out of your way. Just go up and talk to Drifblim, and there you go. And he's a Flying Ghost, who I'm currently using, without getting into too much detail. And he can actually use Fly. So... he could potentially be a flyer throughout the game. I just don't know if I'm going to stick with him the whole time. But I'm enjoying the world design a lot more than the third gen. I'm feeling the variety of the world a little bit more than in Ruby Sapphire.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that'll be for later discussion. We can get further into that.
But yeah, as far as like the variety of the different types, it's limited to a 150. Pokedex, whereas I believe Ruby Sapphire was, what, 200, 250?
Something like that, yeah.
So, less Pokemon, and some of the types suffer because of it. There are not very many fire types.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually a decent amount of electric types. Shinx is, of course, the one to go with.
Yeah, that's a badass.
You can also get to Pikachu. But anyway, we're rambling, so let's close it out here.
All right, sounds good.
Till next time, everybody.
Later. We'll be right back.